This is the Business Report with Gary Strubel on Nova 1035.
It's Thursday evening, 6 p.m. Welcome to the Business Report. I'm Gary Strubel, and for the next hour or so, we'll take you around Namibia and Southern Africa with some of the biggest business stories on the continent. We start out with our lead this evening. Dr. Frans Grenier tells us why he thinks South Africa could turn it around. Certainly a topic around the Braai fires is our cousins down south and how they're managing to pretty much destroy everything they touch. He thinks this could be different. That's coming up in our lead. We also talk to Rosalia Martins-Hausiku, the CEO of the Motor Vehicle Accident Fund. She's in the spotlight this evening sharing her story. Stuart Lohman takes us on a wrap around the BizNews site. Some fascinating stories coming out of South Africa this week. And then Quinton van Rooyen Jr. joins us in the Market Watch. He's the deputy CEO of TrustGo. They won quite a big court battle against the JSE this week. It doesn't finalize matters, but it certainly gives TrustGo a fighting chance in fighting their suspension threatened by the JSE. So stay tuned for that. We'll also have a look at Nedbank's results. They were released this week, and we chat to Salma Halinga, the Manager of Communications and PR at Nedbank, about their results. So lots coming up in the show. Stay tuned. But first, let's take a look at the business flash briefing.
Rebuilding the economy starts now. RMB Namibia Corporate and Investment Banking, proud partner of BizNews.
With your BizNews, I'm Charlize Maslengle. Some South African citrus exports stuck at EU harbors because of new regulations are now being allowed into their country destinations. The new requirements were aimed at tackling the potential spread of the false codling moth. It required the fruit to be kept at extremely cold temperatures of 2 degrees. Aspen Pharmacare will stop making COVID-19 vaccines at its plant in South Africa from the end of this month due to the lack of orders, a senior executive said. Aspen currently produces vaccines for Johnson & Johnson. U.S. inflation eased slightly in July, potentially taking pressure off the Federal Reserve to hike interest rates sharply while bringing a much-needed boost to President Joe Biden just months before crucial midterm elections. Top U.S. gas exporter Freeport LNG has retracted the force majeure it initially declared after an explosion in June, a development that could cost its buyers billions of dollars in losses, a document showed, and three trading sources said. I'm Charlize Maslengle. Stay tuned for more updates.
A sudden storm shouldn't disrupt your long-term outlook. Access RMB's flexible short-term liquidity. Rebuilding our economy starts now. RMB Namibia, a division of First National Bank of Namibia Limited.
Gary Strubel on the Business Report.
Welcome back to the Business Report. You're on Nova 1035. Time now for the lead story. And the lead story is proudly brought to you by Alex Forbes. Alex Forbes, let us help you secure your financial well-being now and in the future. And in studio with us this evening, Dr. Frans Grenier, joining us on his sojourn to Namibia to help think about the future. Frans, welcome back. And I'm interested to hear a little bit about you've been now quite widely quoted, certainly by BizNews, our publishing partners, as having changed your mind a little bit about the future of South Africa. I understand it's a prickly topic, but perhaps you can just give us a sense of why that's such big news.
It's not a prickly topic. I think for 15 years, I was bearish on South Africa's prospects. We made calls in the team that I worked in that we were setting ourselves up for a period of significant economic hardship, that we were unlikely to see the growth materialize that we'd experienced in our first 15 years or decade as a democracy. We made calls that the lights would probably go out because the electricity supply planning and constraints were such. We felt that we would see increased political destabilization. And a very bold call was made in 2012 in writing for the first time in the media, was we felt that on these trends, the ANC and government could lose a future election. That stuff started at the tail end of the Mbeki administration persisted through the era of Jacob Zuma, and we persisted in those calls even after Mr. Ramaphosa came to power. And we were heavily criticized for it. It wasn't a popular message. No, government didn't appreciate it. I think South Africa's private sector appreciated it even less. And it was a tough era. But we were right. And that is very important, and it goes to credibility. South Africa's youth unemployment rate now well over 50%. Debt levels as a share of GDP more than doubled from the low point ANC took debt to at the end of its first decade in government. You will here be familiar with some of the protest actions in the country, the explosion in Natal recently, a mini one of those going on as we speak on the outskirts of Johannesburg, the lights off as we speak, and we've just been through this really hard period of load shedding where power was off for sort of up to 10 or 11 hours a day. And in the middle of that, partly as a consequence of that, the view is shifting to become more bullish. And clients say, how is this possible? Look around, you know, it's a shambles.
There's some pretty bad stuff happening. Yeah.
There's some pretty bad stuff happening, and that is absolutely true. Dig beneath that into public opinion, and you see a very pronounced shift. South Africa becomes a democracy 25 years ago. Chiefly, you could argue, for the reason that if a point was reached where the country was not well governed to the benefit of all its people, that they would have a recourse to change that. And as things began to deteriorate over the past decade, business leaders, perhaps civil society, international observers, diplomats, were hoping that the South African government would, under sufficient pressure, turn to reform, which it hasn't done in the main. And as a consequence, they became very disappointed and very pessimistic on the country and said the government will never change. So your prospects are very bad. Early on, however, it was possible to identify the nascent indicators that South Africa's people were growing disillusioned with their government and administration. That wasn't rapid at first. We did see escalating levels of protest action and so on, all of which are quite good democratic indicators, because they show you an engaged populace that care enough to get out on the streets and protest. What we're starting to see now is that public opinion is turning very, very rapidly. Polls now suggest that the ANC will have a very hard time maintaining its national majority in government. Polls also suggest, have continued to do so, that hasn't changed, that public opinion in South Africa is very moderate and centrist. It's almost center-right. It's not a country overwhelmed by extremist right or left-wing populist sentiment amongst its people, an extraordinarily good piece of fortune in the sense that it means that the risks of a large-scale social destabilization are somewhat limited still. We're also starting to see now the rise of a new generation of political parties. There's a chap by the name of Herman Mashaba. He was a businessman, a former mayor of Johannesburg. He started an outfit really from the ground up, a political party. It's cracking up to 20% of the vote in formerly staunch ANC wards. What I think has started to happen is, on a long lag time, the economic pain and suffering of South African consumers and ordinary people is translating into rapid changes in their voting behavior. If that persists and public opinion remains moderate, there is now a reasonable prospect that over the next decade, coming to power in South Africa's union buildings will be a coalition government. No party will have more than 50% of the vote. A number of these smaller upstarts and a number of smaller, some quite significant, established parties, all of whom are carried by voters who hold mainly pragmatic opinions, will be given a mandate to begin a reform process. So the essence of the analysis then is this, that it is wrong to despair on South Africa because its present government is not moving towards reform. Its people have finally become fed up and they are going to do it. And they're going to put in power a new administration. There might be a seat for what's left of the ANC at that table. That's quite complicated, but don't dismiss the ANC's role in the future government entirely. There are still avenues back for it. But that new administration will have the capacity to replicate many of the successes that South Africa secured in its first decade in government. And it's therefore a very different argument to the sort of traditional take on whether you should be bullish or bearish on South Africa. I think public opinion has broken and is going to present the country with the reform horizon over the next 10 years that, if it takes complete advantage of, will see us rapidly replicate the very real socioeconomic successes that we at first achieved under ANC rule after 1994. So that's the argument.
I think the only counterpoint that we would potentially make as Namibians watching is that it would seem as if, firstly, local government has effectively ceased to function entirely, and that crime in a very organized and professional way, as well as internal political crime and corruption, is now almost entirely endemic. And that creates situations, much like many South American countries, where it's effectively a civil war between civil society and uncivil society. I suppose that's the trajectory that we look at and say, is it so far gone that it can still change back?
Yes, it can, because we've done it before. Go back to the late 1980s in this part of the world. In South Africa, the government's essentially bankrupt. There's the debt standstill. There's Pierre Verwoerd's speech in 1985 when he essentially said no to reform. The Cold War is on the go. There are conflicts in the frontline states, wars fought by conscripts and young activists, including in this country, that you're so very well aware of. The Cold War, as I said, on the go. These apparently insurmountable political chasms. If you'd said, let's say at the peak of the 80s, on South Africa, that within a decade, the last leader of the National Party will become the tourism minister in an ANC government, and you'd said that on a radio platform, perhaps here or there, people would have thought it's very improbable.
Well, you wouldn't have said it.
If you'd, in addition, well, some people did. We can get to them in a moment, but a very small minority. If you'd said that in addition to that, within a decade of coming to power, the South African economy will again be averaging growth rates of around 5% of GDP. It will do so for four consecutive years, so sustained, something that had last happened in the first half of the 1960s. And we will have a budget surplus, which passes for arch fiscal conservatism in Western capitals today. You would have thought this is most improbable. And it was achieved. So we actually are a blueprint of reform ourselves. And it can be done. And there were analysts that made the call. I mean, the very famous scenario planning team at Anglo-American, led by Clem Sunter, they made the same call. They said the high road, low road work that they did. If you're younger, you don't know what I'm talking about, go and Google it. It was a very interesting research study that became very influential in shaping the political evolution of the region. It was done. So it can be done. You are right in one respect, that analysts as a rule around the world have a very poor track record of anticipating political and economic change. I said this at the event last night that launched this Namibia report, where we had some very positive upsides for Namibia, too, at a difficult time as well. You're not in the trouble South Africa's in, but you have your own stresses, very high youth unemployment, debt on the horizon, etc. So analysts, as a rule, have a bad track record on anticipating events. And we understand pretty well, I think, now the reasons why. As a rule, after a crisis that takes you by surprise, the analyst lineup will explain to you why the crisis happened in a very convincing way. And they will do so using data and information and political trends that was in evidence before the crisis happened. What that means is we already have the information to know what's coming next. We just don't know what to do with it. Part of the reason for that is that major political shifts, such as that which I've highlighted for BizNews, is now a plausible result for South Africa. When it starts to change, it comes so fast. There's a Hemingway quote of how two chaps in The Sun Also Rises, a Hemingway a book, talking about bankruptcy. And the one chap says to his friend, "How did you go bankrupt?" And the friend says, "Well, first slowly and then very fast." And that is how political systems and economies go through great transitions, faster than analysts can keep up with. So there are always a small band of slightly maverick analysts that, I mean, I suppose some of my supporters and critics might put me and my former colleagues in that sort of camp, who attempt to use the information and the trends we already have to make quite bold long-term calls about their implications. And when you do, that is what Clem and his team did at Anglo. And I've been very much benefited from the fact that Clem was over years very generous in his advice. And we try and follow that type of methodology, which is why, not through hope or fear, but based on hard economic and political trends and a proper understanding of history, I'm able to stand here for you today and say, out of the depths of violence and load shedding and anarchy and criminality that South Africa is making the headlines for, as an independent and a reputation as a conservative analyst, I think it's plausible now to begin to anticipate the implications of a South Africa that turns the corner in the next decade at the same trajectory that the country last did at the end of the 1980s and into the early 1990s.
We certainly look forward to being able to travel down to South Africa and watch the Springboks play whoever and not fear that we'll have to buy a different car to come back with. Dr. Frans Grenier, thank you so much for joining us here on the Business Report.
A great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's this evening's lead story. Dr. Frans Grenier joining us here in studio. And the lead story proudly brought to you by Alex Forbes. Alex Forbes, let us help you secure your financial well-being now and in the future.
The Business Report. Podcasts on nova.com.na. Namibia's business leader on Nova 1035.
In today's spotlight feature, we're talking to the CEO of the Motor Vehicle Accident Fund, Mrs. Rosalia Martins-Hausiku. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. Good morning to all our listeners.
Let's start us off. Tell us a bit more about Rosalia Martins-Hausiku, what your childhood was like.
Yeah, that's a book to be written. If I have to start, it's long, but I'll try to just shorten it. Rosalia is a girl. I call myself the girl from Sauyama. I grew up in Rundu. I was born in an area called Sauyama. It's just about 8-10 kilometers from Rundu. Most of my childhood, I lived there. And when I went to, after grade 10, I went to Tsumeb. I studied at Etosha High School and I graduated from high school there. And then I went to UNAM. Pretty much my childhood in Rundu, I grew up as a tomboy. Mm-hmm. I was that girl who would be playing without a shirt in the streets, playing soccer. And funny enough, when I first met my husband, he found me in the streets, actually. Probably shirtless. I don't remember much of that. Growing up wasn't so easy, I must say. My parents were not so well off. But there's one thing that I always say, one thing that was always on the table was love. So they taught us all the principles of life, humility, love. And that's really, I think, what built character in me. A lot of times to make ends meet, we, especially holidays, we had to do holiday jobs. And I remember also even when I went on to university, coming back home, I had to work during the holidays. When I was in school holidays, I'll sell tomatoes at the open market. So that's really my childhood. Looking back, yes, you say it wasn't easy, but I think it's part of what built me, you know. Yeah. So I think in a nutshell, that's my childhood. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, having studied mainly in the media studies and communication field, what led to an interest in public sector employment specifically? Was it always the plan or did it develop along the way?
It wasn't. I don't think I thought I would end up in public sector. So this is what happened while I was studying at UNAM. And again, how I ended up there, when I was young, they'd always select the best students, you know, to work on radio, International Children's Broadcasting Day. They would always select me. I'll always participate. And I developed an interest in journalism. And that's how I started. I thought, no, I can do this. I can study journalism. I applied at Rhodes University. I had acceptance at Rhodes University. But then again, I was hoping to get a bursary and my parents couldn't afford to send me there. And then I applied at UNAM as well. UNAM had just introduced the media studies field the previous year. So I was in the second cohort. So eventually I ended up at UNAM. Because I didn't have a bursary. And I remember very well that morning when I was leaving home, my father gave me 4,000 Namibian dollars because that's what I needed for registration. And he said, listen, this is what I could gather. Go and register. I don't know whether I'll be able to pay to continue keeping you there, but just take this and go because I believe in you. My academic results were outstanding. And my father, I don't know how he got that 4,000, but I got to UNAM, I registered, and then after a while I got a buzzer. The rest is history. So when I got to UNAM, I realized that I didn't want to do hardcore journalism. And so then I changed, majored in corporate communication, and I finished. I thought, wow, now I'm going to work to some of the best companies, you know, of what Namibia has to offer. And during that time, I was applying almost everywhere. And I was attending a lot of interviews. I remember I was interviewed by a mine in Rushpina. I was interviewed by Wolfish Bay Municipality. And one of the interviews that was around about the same week, in a 2 weeks time, I attended about three interviews. One of them was the Motor Vehicle Accident Fund. And the CEO then, I remember pre-interview, he invited me, just wanted to know more about me. And then he showed me three different logos and he said, which logo would look great for the MVA Fund? And I chose the logo that eventually became the MVA Fund logo, went through the interview. That's how I ended in public sector, really. It wasn't by design or it wasn't by choice, but that's the company that called me back first. And I thought that this is an opportunity for me to start working in line or in the field of what I studied, which was corporate communications.
Okay. And how did your career evolve then from those first sets of interviews to where you find yourself today as the CEO of the MBA Fund?
Yeah, funny. I always, firstly, there's this virtue of hard work, perfectionism that's in me. I take after my late father, may his soul rest in peace. I work hard, and when you give me a task, I want to complete it, and I want to complete it well. And that's something that really came out in early days in my career. And the CEO that we were working with that time, he had this thing for nurturing talent, and there was a few of us at the fund that were given that opportunity to go study further, or we participated in various developmental programs. I must say, if you look at that first crop that worked at the MVA Fund, a lot of them are CEOs or they are executive at other countries, especially because of their hard work and also that talent was nurtured. And when they saw these opportunities that were given to them, they took them. And for me, then I went, I remember I had this, I felt I needed to further my education in comms. So I did a master's in communication, media studies and culture. But when I came back, I started learning more about the business as well. As much as I was the spokesperson of the company, I took a keen interest in operations as well. Mm-hmm. And as I started learning more about the business, I realized I need to study something probably that would align me to where the business was going. And that's when I did my master's in business leadership. And then there was opportunity to rotate within the company, and I ended up as the chief operations of the organization. And I worked there for maybe 2-3 years, and the then CEO announced that he was leaving. And quite an interesting one. I didn't always see myself as becoming the CEO of the company. at the time already. But there were about three executives at that time when he announced his departure. And I remember consulting a friend and somebody who mentors me in business. And I said, man, this is what's happening. The CEO is leaving. I don't think at this point in my life I want to become the CEO. There's a lot going on. I had a small child. I was expecting my second child. And I felt I wasn't ready. So what do you think? You know, and he gave me the wisest advice probably. He said, look, it's a catch 22. You either apply and get the job and you become the CEO and you think you're not ready. Okay. But, if you don't apply, and he also says, you could apply and not get the job. And then the person that gets the job, if it's an external person, they will always see you as competition and your life might be difficult. But also, if you don't apply, your current board will think you lack ambition. And that's how I applied at the 11th hour. Remember, the agency was PwC. A few minutes before 12, it was closing on the 12 o'clock on that day. I went and submitted my CV, and the rest is history. Then I was the successful candidate.
And you never had to look back.
To look back. One thing is that from the moment that it was announced that I got the job, I think your mindset also changes. Because when you're an executive, and I was the chief operations, there's that time when you act in the position, you know, but it was always refreshing to know the CEO is coming back and you hand him over his office. But when that announcement was made, and you find out, oh my goodness, I'm now, the buck stops with me.
Yeah.
I suddenly had to step into that position and I had to, you know, live up to the expectation. And that's, today we're here.
Well, I mean, you're in fact currently serving your second term as CEO. So obviously it was a good move and things have gone right. How do you feel the organization has grown or changed under your leadership though?
Yeah, I think the organization has grown in leaps and bounds. And probably one of the advantage I had was to be, I've seen the organization move from that dysfunctional organization to where it is now. When we started the MBA fund, it was technically bankrupt. We were that company that everybody will speak about for all the wrong reasons. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of corruption. There was a lot of fraud. And my predecessor started now that transformation. But at the time that he left, still we had one big challenge, which was our financial transformation. When I took over, the company was about 520, 540 million in the red. The headlines were just something else. I remember a few years ago, some of the headlines, MBA Fund balance sheet a wreck. MBA Fund CEO says that they are not bankrupt because government is their guarantor. So we had all these funny headlines. And it was true. That's what was happening. Yeah. We didn't have the money. We had all these claims to pay. And just immediately after I took over, we decided that the board expected a strategy from me. And part of that strategy, the focus was really on a financial turnaround. And I took over in 2013. And by 2016, for the first time in the history of the fund, we were 100% funded. We broke even for the first time.
Nice.
And ever since, we've just been building this institution. I believe that the institution is financially stable right now. I believe that it will be here for years to come. And that was really what we're looking into. When Rosalia is not here anymore, when the executive team that was serving with her is not here anymore, what can they tell about the fund? That the fund is sustainable, that the fund will continue to serve its mandate and the purpose that it was created for. And we, like you said, I'm currently now in my second term, and with my second term, I presented the second strategy to the board. And this strategy is focusing on rehabilitation, where we're saying we want to return people back to work. Mm. We want to return people back to school. And those that cannot work, maybe as close as possible to their pre-crash situation. And with that, you need to focus on rehabilitation, because the past was all about compensation. Mm. You're involved in a crash, here's your money. You know, and we said, wait a minute, something is not adding up. And we're making a lot of strides in that. We're really changing lives. We're making a difference in people's lives, people who are involved in crashes. We are modifying their houses so that they can access their houses. And with the help of some employers are really coming on board. After a crash, whereas in the past a person would be boarded, now employers are working with us and we say, okay, how can we return this employee back to work? Sometimes it's not to the same job. But then they to the same position, but then they would create a position that allows for the employees' newly acquired abilities or for the abilities that are no longer there. And it's really gratifying to see that we're really making a difference out there. We've changed a lot, and also with our partners, we are bringing services that some would say is not in our mandate. But we believe that if we can invest in those areas, the outcome to our patients is much, much greater in the future. For instance, a few years ago, we started the Department of Emergency Medical Care with NAST, and now we are seeing the graduates. A lot of paramedics, before that paramedics were from South Africa. Now we have locally trained Namibian paramedics almost in all the regions in the country. Some are employed by the MVA Fund in the emergency call center. Some are taken up by private sector. And because we're producing now so many, some are even employed elsewhere in Iraq. And they come back. They come back to visit us and they say, this is how I am doing. We now also started a partnership with the University of Namibia, where we set up now a school where we're now training physiotherapists. We are training occupational therapists in Namibia. Sure. Because we started a partnership with the Ministry of Health in Central Hospital, and we set up the very first rehabilitation department in Namibia, because prior to that, we were sending our patients to South Africa. And then we approached Paramount. We set up a step-down facility together, but that was not sufficient. And when we started with Ventuk Central Hospital, also with a Swedish company named Spinalis, we realized now we have the facility, but we don't have occupational therapists. We don't have physiotherapists. And then we thought, where can we quickly train? We're looking at Zimbabwe. We're looking everywhere. South Africa could not accommodate the numbers that that we wanted. We approached the University of Namibia. And this year we saw the first cohort graduating. That is really gratifying for me, looking at that. These are some of the achievements that that we can really boast about. And some will say, are you now a training institution? We're not. But we are not waiting for some magic to happen. We are creating the magic, and we are responding to where the business is moving to.
So like you say, so much more than just compensating people who've been in accidents.
That's right.
As regular listeners of the Business Report know, we like to not only find out more about our spotlight interview subject, business lives, but also get a bit of a glimpse into their personalities. And one of the ways of doing that is to find out a bit more about some of their favorite songs. What song have you chosen for us today, and why?
Yeah, when it comes to that, I'm probably a bit old school. I grew up in the era where the R. Kelly's is what we used to listen to, Mariah Carey, Celine Dion and all that. But I now, I don't really follow contemporary music that much. I'm more into gospel. And I probably don't have one single favorite. But I can tell you now, if you go into my car, what has been playing nonstop is Omtima Wange by Pride. So yeah, that's currently one of the songs that I tend to listen to almost every day. Come on. Tate, Shitulula.
same simple song, same winner. Everybody come on, sing it.
Welcome back to the Spotlight feature on the Business Report on Nova 103.5. Today we're speaking to the CEO of the Motor Vehicle Accident Fund, Rosalia Martins-Hausiku. Having listened to one of your favorite songs and gotten a bit of a look at the lady behind the CEO title, I'd like to do a bit more of that and ask, what motivates you on a daily basis?
A lot.
You said earlier you're a very hard worker, but there must be something driving that.
Yeah, there's a lot that motivates me. I think for me, it's really seeing a difference out there. I believe that every person has something to bring to the table. Every person has something to contribute to this great country of ours. And for me, what motivates me to wake up in the morning, go out there, is the fact that the business that we are in, we change lives. And it's really going out there and thinking, how can I make a difference in the lives of Namibians that are entrusted to us as MVA Fund? In my personal life, what motivates me is really every day is an opportunity for me to become better than I was yesterday.
Speaking of motivation and speaking of that drive, the MVA Fund drive, as a leader, what's the key message that you try to get through to your team and the organization that you run?
Yeah, quite a lot. But if I have to choose one, it's execution. You know, people will possibly remember what you said yesterday. They'll probably be motivated yesterday. But what will motivate people even more, or how they can remember you for years to come, is what you did after you said what you said. Mm. So I'm very much action oriented. I say you can be a well-spoken person. I'm probably not one of those, but when it comes to execution, you must be reliable. People must know that if this is on Rosalia's table, consider it done. And that's what makes a difference.
One last question. I mean, it's often remarked on, I know when we were walking around earlier, it was remarked on as well. You are one of the youngest female CEOs to date. What message would you give to other aspiring young women just starting out? And in fact, to any woman listening?
Yeah, probably to any woman and man. It's and I'll say this again. I've said it before. This world or this position, CEOs, it's a men's world. It was created for men. Just the other day, my husband is a businessman, but before that, there was a time when we were both. He was an MD. He was an MD, and I was a CEO. Okay, so whenever there was a challenge at home or with the kids, I had to call at the office and say, guys, I'm going to be late because I have to take my child. Do you get it? But for my husband, it was more, okay, you take care of this. And when you're stuck, call me. It's almost like only when you're stuck, you call. But as much as it's a men's world out there, one of the pitfalls for us women is thinking that we are not enough. It's really putting it in our head that because it's a men's world, I'll never be able to live up to. Show up as a woman. Show up as a woman. And I always think that as women, we are advantaged because when it comes to leadership, I believe you need to lead with your head. You need to lead with your heart and you need to lead with your feet. And I'm going to say this, that the leading with the heart is not always there for men. And I think it gives us an advantage. So show up as a woman and do your best. My experiences in this position is that they will remind you that you are a woman. A lot of times they might not say it. Their behavior, their demeanor will show that. When you are in a boardroom full of men, which was often the case with me, it's a meeting, it's a boardroom full of men. They will expect you to take notes, you know. But it's for you to stand your ground and be confident of who you are, because you see, when you know what you've got to offer. Firstly, it's that confidence that you know it yourself and you know that you can offer it. You don't have to apologize to anybody. They will make you feel like an imposter. And we speak of having an imposter syndrome. A lot of times it is not, it doesn't come from within. It's imposed upon us. And when it's imposed upon us and we believe that, we become that. But at the end of the day, you need to be confident in who you are. You have to be confident in who you are and what you've got to offer. And unfortunately, if you're just a talk show, then it's just a matter of time before they see that you're a talk show. And that's why I spoke earlier about execution. when people can trust you for delivery, when they can believe that you are able to deliver, just reminds me, you know, John Maxwell says that people, you need to move from a position where people follow you because of a title, because of the position that you got. People will probably just follow me because I'm the CEO, but you need to move from that position. And he defines different ladders. What I like is that they need to a place where they give you permission to lead them. Because why? Because of the results that you're producing, because you're producing results. So when you are confident in that, you are unstoppable. You're unstoppable. You go beyond what they put on you, the labels they put on you, and they also start seeing you and they respect you for that. And you will make mistakes. That's the beauty of this journey. You'll make mistakes, but it's, I just read the other day, one of the lessons in The Alchemist is that you will fall 7 times, but 8 times you will rise. It's really, what are the lessons when I was down and how can I do it better? And especially if you are a leader, you have a bunch of followers who look up to you. You don't want to always show up as that perfect one. One day I said that authentic leadership. I love so much. I in my master classes I speak about authentic leadership. Is how you can lead with the heart, how you can lead authentically, how you can lead ethically. But it's not a style of leadership. It's a way of being. And when you are leading authentically, you acknowledge that as a leader, you also have weaknesses. And sometimes you need to show up as human in front of those that you lead and not always as this perfect leader that they have to aspire to. And also they need to see that it's doable. For the ladies and women at MVA Fund, I always want to show them that as women, it is doable. You don't have to show up as a man. Show up as who you are, a female who is capable.
Well, I think we can safely say, and your track record has proven that you have definitely shown up, not as a female CEO, but as a CEO.
That's right.
Thank you so much for your time.
That's right. Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
The Business Report. Namibia's business leader on Nova 103.5.
The BizNews Wrap is driven by the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology and comfort. Book your test drive today at M&Z Motors. M&Z Motors is proud to introduce the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology and comfort. Contact M&Z Jeep and Fiat Group today for your test drive or visit the M&Z Jeep and Fiat Group Facebook page and check out their great offers. Jeep, go anywhere, do anything.
Welcome back to the Business Report. You're on Nova and as always we go and take a peek over the fence at our neighbours down in SA with our partners biznews.com. Stuart Lohman's on the line. Stuart, welcome back to the show. We took a little break last week, but good to have you back.
Yeah, thanks. Always good to be here, Gary.
Let's start out with chickens. Chickens. It's a fascinating industry in South Africa. For some reason, the Brazilians, well, we know what the reasons are, but the Brazilians are able to come and dump chicken in Southern Africa at a fraction of the price of production, mostly as they're not allowed to dump it in the sea, apparently. So they come and sell it to South Africans. The retailers love it because it cuts the price dramatically of locally produced chicken. But the chicken industry is still an enormous employer in South Africa and obviously a strong part of the GDP. Chickens is a massive business. It's also become, over the last couple of years, massively profitable. But for many years prior to that, before import tariffs were introduced, it was quite unprofitable. Tell us a little bit about the emerging chicken story. It would appear now that the import tariffs have been lifted for a year, and that's going to have a big impact.
Yeah, so that's news from Ibrahim Patel, the minister. It's just for 12 months, as you mentioned, Gary. So just to see, I suppose, one could argue they're looking at the consumer for once, yeah, because that's what they use as the benchmark for the tariff. So to help consumers, which are obviously, as we've seen with inflation numbers that have come out, are hugely under pressure. So they're looking to just suspend it for 12 months. As you mentioned, there's always two sides to every sort of story and every move. So we'll see what this does for profitability on the business side. We know that tariffs are generally a big thing across industries. So who knows if it's a benchmark to see how they manage other sort of imports, et cetera. But from a consumer point of view, hopefully good news on a cost point of view, hopefully the quality doesn't drop too much. But yes, we'll have to see how it plays out. But it's a 12-month period, and hopefully it works out for consumers and see what happens to business.
So typically, I mean, tariffs are an interesting item for protection of local industries. Interesting that they didn't think to just lower the tariff instead of abandoning it altogether, because you've effectively removed all protection from the local industry. And the international producers that often can't sell the product in the markets they're operating in due to either local tastes or standards, especially in Europe where they're pretty strict on their food hygiene standards. You know, just like with vehicles, a dumping ground is also not good for the consumer. Do we expect some pushback from the poultry industry on this?
I'm sure we will, Gary. I know we'll see what the next chip is, in a sense, to see who plays the next card. So I think, again, it's a 12-month period, but I'm sure before we get started the 12 months, there will be a lot of discussions behind closed doors, et cetera, and we'll have to see what comes out. But as you say, there's pros and cons to either or, so why not just shave a little off, you know? But I'm not, unfortunately, a fly on that wall, not in those discussions. So who knows what the reason behind the moves are, but yeah, have to wait and see, unfortunately.
Let's move on to a business story now. Nedbank reporting results, and often banks are good canaries in the cage for how the economy is faring. We hear horror reports about no power, riots, South Africa's broken, everything's, but these banks seem to keep pulling out amazing results. And once again, Nedbank reports strong earnings and lifts its interim dividend. That's got to say something's going right in South Africa.
Yeah, there's also the flip side to that, though. If you look at banks, do sort of benefit from high interest rates with regards to lending, et cetera. So there's always it's a tale of two halves. But numbers are fantastic. You can see the performance across the banking board as well. And as you say, that's generally a sign that things are improving. I see one of the big sort of marketing points of the results was back at pre-COVID levels with regards to dividends, et cetera. So a positive sign. So let's see. The consumer, how under pressure the consumer is, we'll have to also wait and see, though, with regards to future earnings. But a good sign from an economic point of view, and it is across the banking board as well. It's not just Nedbank. We've seen good earnings coming out of all sort of the big four, which is probably more of a big five, a big six nowadays.
So, I mean, just to quote some of these numbers, headline earnings increased by 27%. Nearly 7 billion rand in headline earnings. I mean, that's firstly an enormous business, but to grow by 27%, that's not just a good year. That would infer, to some extent, has COVID largely been cancelled out?
Yeah, like you say, so if you look at the numbers back to pre-COVID levels, so one would assume with that the economy should be at a similar level in terms of pre-COVID. What damage COVID has done to the consumer is not being seen with regards to savings that were used. I mean, people are trying to pull money from all sorts of sort of holes that, you know, wouldn't have been touched until retirement ages were hit. So I think the impact on that you'll only see later down the line. But in with regards to earnings across the banks, back to pre-COVID levels, so positive. Percentages, also got to be mindful of percentages, Gary. You know, 27% is a big number, but if you look at the period that it was against, there's probably a few months of lockdown, et cetera, et cetera. So the positive thing is if you compare numbers back to a pre-COVID, which can only be good, interest rates are back to that pre-COVID level as well. And that people sort of forget about. So hopefully forward from here.
Okay. Then lastly, let's touch on, I see that I've only picked up on episode 9 in the series, but Tim Noakes is not a man who's afraid of having an opinion on a number of topics. It's part 9 is around insulin resistance. Tell us a little bit about the series that Tim Noakes is running on the site.
Yeah, I mean, for those, Tim Noakes is a former sort of researcher, very well known in the sports world. I suppose good to go back a bit here is back in the day, Tim pushed carbo loading as a key to sort of, you know, he's big into running, and that was one of the drivers he felt in terms of performance. Obviously, what you do in the science world, it's when you shift, there's a lot of skepticism about when your thinking shifts, and Tim's thinking shifted to this low-carb, high-fat sort of diet, which goes against what was initially proposed. So what the series is about is just looking at sort of the reasons behind this and how science, as you'll see in this, the latest sort of part is the right word. I think it's 11, 12 parts sort of series of that he's put together. But how science was used to sort of market certain sort of moves, but hadn't been proved sort of, you know, but marketed as a fact, as he says. So I don't know. It's a fascinating read. It's a long read though, Gary. I suggest people, I wouldn't be able to surmise the, I don't know how many thousand words times 11 that'll come, but Tim's a very well-read, well-researched, fascinating, independent thinker who puts, you know, thoughts together, and it's just a good rendition. And obviously, Tim also suffers from diabetes, so he lives a lot of the stuff he talks about as well. He's been through it. It's a good look. I was saying we sort of become biz health when Tim's around.
He certainly sparks a lot of debate as well. And I mean, is you would have had contact with Tim? Is he the kind of guy who likes debate, or does he have a point of view and will defend it to the death?
No, I mean, he's very well softly spoken. He's a fascinating character. So I do believe he will sort of debate. I don't see him stepping down. And you can see, I think he's learned a lot from his history. I mean, if you look at to change one's own mindset is probably the toughest of all, Gary. And he's done that. He's literally put everything he did in the past and changed it on a flip. So, and it's against everything he said, like 180. So, fascinating character, lovely to chat to, very well, you know, as I said, well versed, and has a point of view.
Well, the story, part 9 of the series, is called It's the Insulin Resistance Stupid, and basically talks about research that's been buried that largely drives our understanding of modern nutrition, certainly how many parents would see feeding their children. And in Tim Noakes's mind, has been the results of a disastrous epidemic of obesity and type 2 diabetes that has resulted as largely as a result of our obsession with sugar in our diets and how we manage our own insulin system. So a fascinating read there. I see the lights are still on, so congratulations on keeping the lights on for a week. You guys are doing us proud. Well done on clapping the All Blacks last weekend. Any predictions for this one? They certainly didn't look like the All Blacks, did they?
Yeah, normally you'd be afraid of a wounded All Black, Gary, but I don't think we should be too afraid. I think they've got a lot of problems they need to deal with, and I think they're ripe for the picking. So let's hope we give it to them.
Well, we'll see. They're playing up in Johannesburg this weekend after a very one-way victory by the Springboks last weekend. Stuart Lyman, always good to chat to you. Thank you so much, and we'll chat again next week.
Thanks, Gary.
That's it for this week's Biz News Weekly Wrap. You can catch all of those stories and more. That's on biznews.com.
The Biz News Wrap is driven by the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology, and comfort. Book your test drive today at M&Z Motors.
Gary Struble on the Business Report.
Welcome back to the Business Report. You're on Nova 103.5, and time now for the Market Watch and an interesting turn of events for local company Trusco. The Johannesburg Stock Exchange has lost its attempt to suspend Trusco from the bourse. The Namibian company brought an urgent application to the High Court in South Africa to stop the JSE from enforcing a decision by a financial services tribunal to suspend the company's listing. In addition to stopping JSE from suspending the financial services company, the trading in the shares of the financial services company, the court also restrained it from implementing the decision that Trustco restate its annual financial statements for the year ending 31st of March 2019. This is according to a statement issued by Trustco. Our guest this evening is Quinton van Rooyen Jr., the Deputy CEO and Alternate Director to the Group Managing Director. Quinton, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. Right, let's dig into it. This has been proclaimed by Sense and on your website as well as a victory against the JSE. This tussle's been running for a couple of months now. Just perhaps give us some context. The JSE had a financial services tribunal that ruled that you guys should be suspended. Trading in your shares should be suspended on the JSE. You fought that. You've gone to the High Court now, and you've had an urgent interdict to stop that suspension from happening. Is that correct? Just give us some context for how this has all come about.
Correct. The process you summarized is absolutely correct, but I think it's important to give some context to how we got here. And to summarize it in short, we have a difference of opinion on accounting principles. We, our Trustco Group board, together with our auditors and our independent advisors, and on the other side, you have got the JSE and the tribunal that sees IFRS application in a certain way. That difference of opinion have now led us all the way into the High Courts of South Africa, where we now need an independent High Court to take a position on whose view on these accounting principles are correct. So that's the basis of the dispute with the JSE. But the effect it has, the JSE during that process wants to suspend the trading of the Trustco shares. And therein lies a lot of damage to shareholders, potential investors, and a lot of uncertainty. So the board has taken the JSE to task and to High Court so that we have clarity over these principles. Ultimately, for the group, whatever the court decides of how these accounting transactions should be treated, we will welcome. Keep in mind it's 2018, 2019 financials. It's way in the past. It changes nothing on the company level. But we want certainty about this IFRS applications. It's obviously critical for the integrity of the financial statements, and it's critical to the reputation of the company that we need certainty around this.
I mean, so one of the impact is obviously confidence. Share price is ultimately a measure of confidence in the company. Since the beginning of the year, we're down 71% from 114 to 46. There was a little bit of a spike yesterday on the news, and then opening this morning down again. Of course, that's all quite volatile, so we can't take that too seriously. Let's dig into the issue quickly. The issue revolves essentially around valuation of property and moving it from one category to another in terms of...
Correct.
IFRS, and I've had many dealings with IFRS in my life, is an annoyance to most business owners, and some of the rules don't even really make sense as to, but it is an international standard. What is the harm in just restating it as per the JSE regulations?
Yeah, if we would love to restate and just continue with our lives. However, our independent external auditors have taken a view that if we follow the approach of the IFRS application that the JSE has, they will have to qualify our financial statements. So the board and the Trustco management sits a little bit between a rock and a hard place. We simply, the worst case position a company can find itself in is with qualified statements. So we have to follow the advice of our external auditors. For us, it doesn't matter which way it goes, we need certainty. So we cannot simply roll over and take the advice of the JSE at the expense of what our external auditors advice has given us. And ultimately, one must consider the board takes responsibilities for the financials that you sign off, not the JSE, not the auditors, nowhere else. So if the board signs off in a set of financial statements that the auditors disagree with, you can have all sorts of other havoc and proceedings pop up in its place. So for us, we cannot wait to have this settled whichever way it goes, but to simply take the restatement as a JSE wants will then open up another avenue of problems for us.
Okay. And has this stopped 2020 and 2021's audited financials from being accepted and being fined?
No, not at all. And as I like that you asked the question, because 2020-21, we also published financial statements, also signed off by the auditors and also approved by the JSE and also approved by shareholders. So typically with a restatement, if you take a restatement, you must carry that forward into your next financials. So this is sort of in a vacuum, that 18-19 period, because if we restate, we have to carry that restatement all the way up to our present financial statements, which if it has to be done, then we do it.
Quite aside from a qualified audit, and we find public institutions all over Africa with qualified audits on a regular basis, and they continue functioning. Would a restatement materially affect the going concern nature of Trustco?
So let me take a step back. A qualified audit report triggers certain things. So if you get a qualified audit report on the JSE, you get automatically suspended. Keep that in mind. Qualified audit report also becomes an automatic event of default with lenders and borrowers in the group. So a qualified audit report by default puts the going concern status into question. So it's something you simply cannot roll over and do. Public institutions with qualified reports, it doesn't matter to them because it goes on business as usual. Their lenders are usually the government or pension funds, etc. But for publicly traded company, it's a completely different ballgame.
Absolutely.
We simply cannot have a qualified report, and that's why we're fighting this tooth and nail.
What percentage of your shareholding is on the float?
36%. I'm speaking under correction, but around 36%.
All right, so it's material. It's
material.
It's a big chunk of your shareholders sit in a publicly traded space.
Yeah. We've got 3,000 public shareholders, and the majority of them sits in Europe and the USA, where we've got funds like Sequoia, MIT, Notre Dame. These are serious institutions with that manage billions of dollars all over the company that's invested in Trustco. So a qualified audit report is devastating to us. So I hope that gives a bit of perspective why we fight this so tooth and nail.
Absolutely. Okay, so what happens next? You've won this. You've created an interdict to stop the suspension of trading in shares.
Yeah.
What happens next?
So on the 5th of September, I think the hearing will go full circle.
That is with the High Court.
That's with the High Court in South Africa. And I'll take a step back here and explain why the interdict is so important. Because in order to get granted an urgent interdict, the court must look at your prospects of success of your overhanging or review application. And that's why this one is so important to us. What happens next? Business as usual. We must continue with operating our businesses. We must make sure that the financial viability of our businesses grows and continues from here on. What happens on the top level, on a compliance level, and with the share price and listings, that will follow its natural course. The board will at some point decide whether a listing on the JSE is still as efficient as we want it to be or as it was in the past, and we'll take a decision going from there.
Trustco naturally listed on a couple of bourses, including the local one. Has the local bourse taken in, paid any attention to this issue?
So the structure is set up like this. We've got a primary listing on the JSE, secondary listing on the Namibian Stock Exchange, and secondary listings on the OTCQX in New York. So what happens is the local listings follow, of course, whatever happens on the – or the secondary listings follow what happens on the primary listing. So whatever happens on the primary listing will be duplicated on the secondary listing. I'm sure the local stock exchanges and all others have taken notice because it's a critical thing. But as soon as you want to make a move on your primary stock exchange, you will have to inform your secondary stock exchanges as well.
Okay. Right. So let's good luck with the hearing. I did note that the JSE was ordered to pay costs for the interdict. So
that's always a good
some
one.
Some satisfaction.
Oh, yes.
Just before we move on, how does this affect the relationship with the JSE? Naturally, a marketplace is a good place to have a good relationship with. Must muddy it a little bit.
It's dynamic and troublesome at the best of days. I can tell you that. maybe I can take a chance here to say that no public company wants to fight in an open forum in a high court with the regulators that it engage with, but simply for the fact because the market sees the regulator generally as correct. They've got 114 years of experience. They've got the best in the world, et cetera, et cetera. But there comes a point in time where a company cannot simply just roll over and accept what has been done for the past 100 years versus what is right. So the relationship is not great. Can we patch it up? It's possible. We'll see.
And I noted in the articles and in the sense around the initial judgment, you guys are saying, well, you didn't have any IFRS experts at the tribunal that was dealing with an IFRS issue. That's quite straightforward, right?
It's a critical point. And I mean, if you think about it, we have independent IFRS advisors that is accredited by the JSE to advise us on these specific topics. And the JSE goes against their own accredited advisors. So you can imagine the lines where the law and accounting merge is quite a special one. You've got specialized litigators or legal professionals and accounting professionals. And the one typically doesn't want to rule over the territory or step in the territory of the other. It's practice, and we've seen it happen many a times. But the first ruling we got from the tribunal, not a single IFRS expert, I'm not even talking about expert, I mean anyone that's got accounting knowledge, was on that tribunal. And the chair of the tribunal acknowledged that in his public record. He said, we simply do not have the skills to deal with this matter. So it's something, you know, that needs to be addressed.
Good luck with the hearing. Let's move on to perhaps what could be good news. I picked up while I was just doing a bit of background reading on the tribunal issue, on the sense that a term sheet has been entered into in terms of which SJSL Investments Limited shall have the option to become a 70% shareholder in Mayo Mining. And this is, of course, the diamond mine in Sierra Leone, for a total subscription amount for up to $50 million. This is good news.
Yeah, absolutely. It's major for us. We've built the mine. We've taken the risk of Trustco Capital over the past 4 years to build the mine in Sierra Leone. We spend about $60 million to bring that mine up to production, get the mining licenses in place. And now we've brought in a private equity fund to upscale it to significant to its commercial value at the end. So it's great news for us. It's typical Trustco style business where we take an asset or we acquire asset, we build it up and bring in a partner and bring it to market.
It also raises a lot of cash, around about $800 million Namibia dollars. Are you taking that money off the table, or is that going pouring back into the big hole that a mine can be?
No. So that money comes back to the group. That's basically a recovery of our investment that we've done over the past 3 years. But we are investment group. You don't want to sit on cash. Cash in the bank simply runs down over time. So we'll find a place to park it.
Okay. And in between, you guys can buy lunch again.
That's a good point.
I see the timelines on this are fairly tight, running through August and September. Typically for a transaction of this size, that seems like there's a whole lot of conditions precedent that happen very quickly, and then they get an option to continue on.
Yep.
So that it's not the $800 million up front. It'll come in a number of tranches.
Correct. And some of those tranches we actually already received. Some of the CPs we've already ticked. We've gone through the financial due diligence, the legal due diligence. The next big step is the geology due diligence on the ground, which we've also passed. So some of that funding has already flown. I think there's 7 steps, if I'm not mistaken, of tranches. And the first 4 we've already received and we've already ticked those boxes. So these transactions take about 18 months to complete in full circle. We already down the line, about 12 months of that work has been done prior to the announcement. But we've crossed that Rubicon where we have to make an announcement where we see the transactions becoming certain. So we passed that line.
Well, good news. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And we look forward to the thousands of carrots that mine will continue to produce for both you and your shareholders.
Absolutely.
Quinton, we'll catch up soon. There's lots to talk about in Trustco, and you're welcome back anytime. So thanks for popping in and clarifying. We'll touch in after the 5th and hear how things went.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
That's Quinton van Rooyen Jr., the Deputy Group CEO of Trustco, talking about a victory against the JSE earlier this week, where an interdict was successful in stopping the JSE from suspending trading in shares in Trustco. Trustco up yesterday, but down again in early trading. That's this evening's Market Watch here on the Business Report.
The Business Report. Podcasts on nova.com.na. The Business Report. Thursdays from 6 to 7 on Nova 103.5.
We turn now to results. Nedbank released its results recently, Nedbank Namibia. And to find out a little bit more about what's behind the numbers, Angie Skoltz catches up with Selma Kaulinga, the manager of communications and PR at Nedbank.
Good evening, Selma. How are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you, Angie?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak to you.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Nedbank released their results. I see the Nedbank Group, there was a 27% jump in headline earning. What is this attributed to?
Okay, so just to go back, so the Nedbank Group, the whole group released their results yesterday. So this is the group, and the Namibian results will be released later this month once they get through board approval, but they are also positive results. I think the jump in headline earnings can be attributed to, I think we are looking at numbers that are above the 2019 pre-COVID interim dividend level. So I think we can see that maybe we are recovering from the COVID. I know interest rates are still high and stuff like that still play a role, but I think that is that the fact that maybe we are coming out of the COVID pandemic, I think we are starting to see numbers that are even higher above the 2019 pre-COVID interim dividend level.
Wonderful news. Then, Salma, can you maybe tell us what were some of the highlights?
Okay, some of the highlights are headline earnings for the group have increased by 27%. Our ROE increased to 13%, and the cost of income ratio also has improved. Capital and liquidity ratios are robust. And like I said, this is a reflection of group. I can't bring it home and just speak about Namibia's great progress in non-financial metrics, just stuff that we can speak about that's not really financial. Like I said, the results will come out at the end of the month. But overall, Nedbank Namibia has seen an increase in our clients, and so our client growth has grown. The Nedbank Money app continues to be rated highly on Apple Store. So we're seeing our strategy to move towards digital in our results. By the end of June, our digital transactions have increased almost by 30%. So we've also fulfilled our digital strategy. You know, Nedbank, like I said, the Money app has gotten a lot of has been rated well, but we also Nedbank is also powers Pay Today, as we know, which is also a digital platform. And so these are the things that we can speak about the Namibian results.
We all know that banks, just like businesses, took a knock with COVID-19. What are some of the projections going forward?
I think going forward, like I said, there is already, we can see a slight, we can see a slight increase in the numbers. Obviously, the interest rate has risen, and it might continue to rise as we can forecast. But these are some of the forecasts we can speak about. Nedbank Namibia is still committed to obviously our clients, supporting our clients. Like you said, we are moving more to digital. I can say that Nedbank Namibia is going to launch the much anticipated app called Avo. Avo is already launched in South Africa, but it's an app where it's like a marketplace ecosystem, which is basically clients can go in there and shop and then get their goods delivered to their doorstep. So we're trying to introduce that into the market in this second half of the year. So there's great things to look forward to. Obviously, the economy still has to improve, but Nedbank is really committed to serving our clients, to serving our customer base, and really looking to the strategy of moving to into more digital spaces.
That's our producer, Angie Skoltz, talking to Salma Kaulinga, the Manager of Communications and PR about Nedbank, about their results recently released.
It's the Business Report with Gary Strubel. The Business Report. Thursdays from 6 to 7 on Novo 1035.
I'm David Bishop with your weekly economics wrap. The Namibia Travel and Tourism Forum has launched a tourism info bot on WhatsApp, focusing on marketing Namibia as a destination and providing tourists on-demand information about the country, various regulations, flight schedules, and the ability to search a directory of registered Namibian tourism companies. While in an effort to revive the tourism industry, the Namibia Tourism Board has launched a new website, digital marketing campaign, and foreign mission toolkit focused on rebuilding consumer confidence to drive a swift travel recovery valued at $350,000. The Ministry of Industrialization and Trade is warning the public to be cautious of a scam circulating on social media under the title Official Grants Application Form, targeting entrepreneurs and SMEs in need of financial assistance and grants. And the Namibia Chamber of Commerce and Industry recommended that commercial public enterprises go into partnerships with private sector firms as a strategy to improve operational efficiency and help parastatals run profitably. The Bank of Namibia says the mining sector will drive growth over the next 18 months, with most sectors under secondary and tertiary industries expected to show positive but low growth rates. Here is Simonis Storm Securities economist Theo Klein with more.
Bank of Namibia reduced their growth forecast for this year for similar reasons why we have maintained our very low growth forecasts for 2022. We are at 2.5% compared to Bank of Namibia's revised 3.2%, and they mainly see growth, their forecast being supported by the mining sector. While we are also positive on the mining sector to support growth overall for this year, it's not necessarily the kind of growth that Namibia needs. With the mining sector being fairly capital intensive, they can naturally increase their production levels and contribute more positively to GDP growth without necessarily employing a lot more people.
In what could potentially be good news for Namibia too, John Hudson, National Head of Agriculture at Nedbank, says that the worst part of the food price crisis faced by South African consumers could be over. Staying in South Africa, families of slain Marikana miners are suing the state and President Cyril Ramaphosa for R1 billion. And speaking of Cyril Ramaphosa, the president reportedly only had $600,000, or 10 million Namibia dollars, stolen from his Palapala game farm, significantly less than the 4 million, or about 66 million Namibia dollars, reported by many media outlets. Nigeria is threatening to withdraw from the regional group, the Economic Community of West African States, following allegations that Nigerian candidates are being sidelined for jobs and promotions. And according to a new poll of economists, the Indian economy may have grown at nearly 15% in the first quarter of the year, signaling a strong post-pandemic recovery. The United States Senate passed a sweeping healthcare tax and climate package worth hundreds of billions of dollars that represents the largest climate investment in U.S. history. And the International Air Transport Association, the global representative body of the airline industry, recently reported that recovery in air travel remains strong, showing healthy and stable performance, with the annual data showing a 76.2% increase compared to June 2021.
Namibia's business leader on Nova 103.5.
Another big week here on the Business Report. As always, thanks to Angie Schultz, our producer, Raymond Ziefeld, our technical producer, David Bishop, for chipping in as well during the week. And also to thanks to all our guests for joining us. It's always wonderful to hear exactly what's going on from the people in the know. Most of all, thanks to you for listening. If you caught something and you want to hear more of it, then the podcast is on nova.com.na. This episode, as well as all of our previous episodes, you can go catch up on there, catch up with us on Twitter. You can also pop us a mail, tbr@nova.com.na. If you'd like us to do something different or do something better, please let us know. That's it for this week. We'll be back with more stories, more business reports next week. Have a great evening.
That was the Business Report on Nova 103.5. Listen to all the segments and previous episodes with our podcast service on nova.com.na. The Business Report was presented by Gary Strubel and produced by Angie Schultz and David Bishop. Comments and questions can be sent to tbr@nova.com.na.